My name's Abby Kinney, and you are listening to Upzoned. Hello, and thank you for listening to another episode of Upzoned, where we take one big story from the news each week and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth. My name is Abby Kinney, and I am a planner at Gold Evans and am joined today by Daniel Harrigus, who is the senior editor of Strong Towns. How are you today, Daniel?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Abby.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining me on this lovely Friday. The article that we are going to cover today was published by the MIT Press Reader by an author named Elaine Berto, and it is entitled, Do We Really Want Our Mayors to Have a Vision? Berto basically makes the case that mayors and municipal staff should be not considered visionaries, but a coordinated team of managers and janitors. To me, at first glance, the author's philosophies or arguments appear to align pretty strongly with the Strong Towns thinking in that he describes the undesirable outcomes that can spur from sort of authoritarian leadership styles. In fact, he actually writes that visionary leadership implies a top-down approach, but a city is mostly created from the bottom up. That line in particular actually made me question what it means to be a visionary and if that actually implies an inability to carry out a more democratic leadership style. Personally, I reject the notion that you can't be a visionary in a democratic way. I think there's actually a lot of value that you can get out of visionary thinkers in various roles. However, there is a fine line between a leader that supports the community versus one that tries to impose personal desires on a community. I'm curious what your first take on this was, Daniel.
Yeah, you know, I went into this article expecting to really like it because Berto published a book last year called Order Without Design that got a whole bunch of buzz in some of the circles I follow, some of the planners that I know, and also people who are kind of market urbanist inclined. And the gist of the whole book is a lot of the themes that we talk about at Strong Towns about how cities are complex adaptive systems, and they have this organic evolving aspect to them that is beyond the capacity of any authority, no matter how democratic, no matter how well-intentioned, to manage in a top-down orderly way and ensure predictable outcomes. When I read the article, I got a little bit hung up on a couple of the examples that he uses, which we may have the chance to talk about in a bit, I think, but also on just the semantics of what it is that Berto is actually trying to say. You know, when he says that we don't want our mayors to have a vision because that implies top-down, almost authoritarian control of this organic, you know, living, breathing entity that is the city. I get lost a little bit there. You know, what does it mean for an elected official to have a vision? And, you know, Abby, so as someone who actually works in the planning field and works with local governments and with municipal officials, is there a difference between the role of a mayor in terms of setting the vision or setting some overarching priorities for a community, or the role of a city council versus like the role of the city manager and the planning staff? What do you think about that?
Yeah. So at first, I think kind of lumping in a mayor with staff and just saying that they all should be managers of the city is a little bit simplistic. I do agree that the role of government should, as a baseline, be competence. But I actually don't think that it's a mayor's role to be a manager. A mayor is elected to be a leader, and they are often elected because they have a vision or some sort of perspective that people can get excited about. Elected officials might not have the adequate training to take on a management role within a city. It seems that there's sort of a misunderstanding in this article about the various roles of people within city government. I think that elected officials, they kind of are the people inside government that can help inspire vision or get people excited about a potential direction for a city. The elected officials are then responsible for appointing a variety of people to help shape policy and provide advice. and that sort of feedback that we're talking about. The Planning Commission, for example, is an appointed body that is responsible for adopting long-range planning policies. The policies are intended to be really insulated from politics and instead should be driven by the community's desires, data and facts, as well as market realities. The city staff then has the responsibility for providing technical expertise to carry out the city's initiatives and policies. That being said, a vision certainly holds merit, I think, for elected officials. And after all, that is typically why they get elected. And I think that election cycles can help move the needle in terms of shining light on things that can and be improved within a city. But a city is set up to have the checks and balances that are intended to prevent a mayor, for example, or other elected official from having the authority to just carry out their own desires for a community, whether or not that's how any particular government actually works is a question. But that's certainly the intention of the checks and balances within a city.
Sure, sure. Now I might push back on that a little, because in theory we have these checks and balances, but in practice, I think you and I both know there are a bunch of examples where you have a mayor or you have a really assertive council person ram through their particular pet project or their particular priority. And it's something like, okay, we're going to have this convention center. We're going to have this arts district. We're going to build a stadium. So I think there are cases, and I think that this is maybe what Berteau is trying to critique, is when the vision becomes this really particular, like, you know, you got a pet project, you got something that you want to be really prescriptive about, or you've got a blueprint for how something should happen. How would you describe the appropriate line where something really passes from being in the realm of the visionary mayor, the elected official, to the realm of the managers and janitors, the staff to implement? You know, is there a difference here between setting priorities, setting values that you want to pursue in your policymaking versus saying, you know, micromanaging the zoning map, for example, from the mayor's office?
Exactly. I think that you're right on point that seems to be the real critique that is coming out of this article, or at least what I think the author is trying to say, and that elected officials and planners, quite frankly, are guilty sometimes of trying to be overly prescriptive with how they desire things to turn out in a city. And arts districts and even innovation districts can play that role in being sort of a top-down strategy for prescribing outcomes for a particular geography, which is definitely not a strong towns approach to city building. We really want to be able to create feedback loops within a city, and that often doesn't happen when we have these pet projects or moonshot projects that are initiated by an elected official and don't really go through the process that I was talking about before. So we know that kind of the theoretical approach of how city government should work doesn't always work out that way. Unfortunately, these projects are top-down approaches to city building that really should be critiqued, and that's exactly what I think the author is trying to do. I think that that's where the city management side of things is so important, that city managers should be responsible for setting up those feedback loops and making sure that government is functioning in a way that is not only competent, but empowers people to have ownership in their community and carry out bottom-up strategies.
Right. I think there's a role for city government that is somewhat activist, that isn't simply being the super dispassionate, the technical expertise, the manager, the janitor, as Berteau puts it. To me, the way I would characterize that is I want to see all sorts of great innovation bubbling up from the ground in a city. I want to see entrepreneurs doing their thing. But then I want to see city staff see their role as, how can we nurture this? If you got a good thing going, how can we connect you with the information and the resources you need and help you navigate this process to scale up your good thing? You know, whether it's like a new food truck or a pop-up market or something. And I've mentioned this to you before, Abby. I think one thing that's really telling to me is the disparity that you see out there and how cities respond to something like, let's say, tactical urbanism. For listeners who aren't familiar with the term, do you want to define tactical urbanism, Abby, or do you want me to?
Go right ahead. I'm curious how you'd like to define it.
So I would define tactical urbanism, which is something we've written a lot about at Strong Towns over the years. It is the notion of sort of informal citizen-initiated projects to address aspects of the public built environment, the public realm, and streetscapes and things like that, where the city isn't stepping in to intervene in a way that the neighbors really want. So a classic example would be the efforts of street safety advocates to do things like paint crosswalks at dangerous intersections or use traffic cones to create sort of a do-it-yourself bulb out where there isn't a curb that will force drivers to slow down and pay attention and yield to people walking. And a lot of those advocates are really frustrated when they're working with a city administration that seems indifferent to them. You know, we've got our protocols. This is the schedule for when we're going to deal with this street and that street. It's in the capital improvement plan, and we're not going to deviate from that. And meanwhile, you've got an intersection where people are getting hurt or killed, or they're narrowly avoiding that, and the city won't step in. So there's a famous anecdote out of Seattle, maybe a decade ago at this point, where a group of Seattle residents went out to an intersection in their neighborhood that they knew was a huge problem. And they went out in the middle of the night with paint and stencils, and they did their own crosswalk, which is not a legal thing to do just about anywhere. And they did it essentially as an act of protest and as an act of frustration. We need to deal with this. The city isn't responsive to us. We're just going to do it. We're going to paint a crosswalk. There needs to be one. And Seattle's city engineer had the best response to that. His name is Dong Ho Chang. Everybody should follow him on Twitter. He's amazing. He still runs the Seattle Department of Transportation. And where I think a lot of transportation officials would have said they would have directed their staff out the next day to remove the crosswalk and paint over it, and they might have tried to fine the residents for, you know, vandalizing the street or for interfering with that public space. What Dong Ho Chang did was he approached that neighborhood group immediately and he said, you know, what you did, it was, you know, outside of our plans. It was not technically legal. You shouldn't have done it. But I also want to thank you for bringing this to my attention. And I am going to make sure that I champion this project within my department. And I'm going to make sure that we put a crosswalk there ASAP. And he did. There are so many missed opportunities, I think, for cities to do that kind of thing where you're not simply there to implement the plan that has been arrived at through a democratic process and put down on paper and now it's set in stone. You need to empower the technical experts. You need to empower the people in the bureaucracy to respond to the sort of chaotic but smart feedback that is coming from your citizens who are saying, hey, here's something we want to do and we want to do it right now. And can you help us do it right now?
Yeah, and I definitely think that that's an opportunity for planning to even be less prescriptive and less trying to dictate outcomes necessarily and be a little bit more broad and try to build in some of those feedback systems. This is the perfect example to me where government can act as more of a support system rather than a gatekeeper. And I think that is really what this article is trying to say. Is that the mayor shouldn't be a gatekeeper, or really any government agency shouldn't act as a gatekeeper, but rather should be able to provide the feedback loops that don't prescribe outcomes, but actually support what people say they want. The tactical urbanism approach, I think, is a great way of bringing this to the attention of elected officials. And in my opinion, cities should find more and more ways that they can sort of empower local people to engage with these ideas around improving the public realm or any other kind of small incremental improvements that are community oriented. And in a lot of ways, these pathways are not apparent to most people. And making these systems in place where the city can actually help support citizen initiatives is what I think a great city manager and city staff can help to support and create.
I think you're dead on about prescriptiveness. And, you know, it's not just about creating room to support citizen initiatives, but it's also recognizing that you don't know in advance what they're going to be. And some of them might not be initiatives. You know, sometimes you do need to get out of the way. You know, Berthaud's piece kind of, I feel like it gets lost in a couple examples of situations where he felt the city needed to get out of the way, but that maybe aren't, they're either not representative of the issues that cities face more broadly, or they feel kind of nitpicking and kind of like I think a lot of people would read this article, especially if they're a little more comfortable with activist government, or they're maybe a little more aligned with the political left. I think they would read this article and dismiss the author as like a libertarian crank, like, oh, he just believes the government can't do anything good and can't do anything to benefit people, and we should just let the private sector run roughshod in our cities. Because at a couple points, it starts to read that way. And I think it would be a mistake to read it that way, as though that's the only thing being said.
Yeah, I definitely think a lot of the examples are a little bit convoluted and kind of take us away from what I think the main point was, which wasn't exactly clear the first time I read the article. So,
well, he uses Silicon Valley as an example in a way that I found really, as someone who has lived in Silicon Valley, I found it bizarre and kind of ahistorical and just clueless, frankly. And his whole point about Silicon Valley is, you know, isn't it wonderful that this dynamic, incredibly innovative, incredibly productive tech industry developed out of, you know, a bunch of 20-somethings, you know, broke 20-somethings tinkering in their garages, you know, with transistors and stuff. And wouldn't it be a shame if the cities of Silicon Valley had tried to overregulate this industry by, you know, requiring all of the tech companies to locate in a specific industrial zoning district or something like that? Which, that reads to me like the take of someone who doesn't know anything about Silicon Valley, because Silicon Valley is an extremely hyper-regulated suburban place. It is a bunch of bedroom communities. It's automobile-oriented. You got kind of a one-mile grid of superstrodes and residential single-family home neighborhoods in between them on cul-de-sacs and strip malls. Like, and in this environment, like, I mean, people romanticize like the garage that Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak started Apple in, or the garage that Hewlett and Packard worked out of. And I hear that and I think, well, they were doing their work in a garage because that was the only option available to them. And that this tech industry arose in this environment kind of in spite of the city planning that was going on around them, and in no way because of it. So I just had to roll my eyes when Berthaud goes off on a digression about Silicon Valley and how great it was that the enlightened leadership of Silicon Valley didn't try to regulate the sector out of existence. And I think, well, they didn't do a whole lot to help it along either.
It was a little bit of a simplistic explanation of Silicon Valley, and I'm not even that familiar with Silicon Valley, and I immediately kind of thought that that was not a very good example for supporting what I think he was trying to say, and what I think has some merit and is certainly worth having discussion over. We are running out of time, so I think we ought to move on into the down zone. My contribution to the down zone this week is actually not a book, but a podcast that I've been listening to. I've been listening to a podcast called The Dream this week. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of it, Daniel, but it's actually pretty interesting. I'm listening to the second season, which is covering kind of the overall nature of the wellness industry. But the first season of it, which I really enjoyed, investigated multi-level marketing and had a lot of interviews around how the industry actually works, and went all the way up to how legislation and how politics are involved in the industry. So I found it really interesting. And with the second season, they're jumping into sort of taking on the wellness industry in a similar manner. So I've been finding that very interesting, and it's not planning related, but it's definitely worth a listen.
Doesn't have to be planning related. That's the point of the down zone, right?
Yeah.
Believe it or not, folks, we do have other interests sometimes.
Yes, we do.
So a lot of my reading material lately, admittedly, has been books about babies and childbirth, because my daughter is going to be born in theoretically about a month here. So that's occupying most of my mind these days when I'm not doing Strong Towns work. I did manage to read one work of fiction recently that I absolutely loved. I recently finished a novel. It's not exactly new. It's I believe it was from 2016, but it's called The Sympathizer by Viet Thanh Nguyen. And it is a novel written from the perspective of a communist North Vietnamese spy living in Southern California after the Vietnam War. And it's absolutely fascinating. It's just delightful because the book sort of takes glee in turning on its head all of the stereotypes that white Americans tend to have about that war. But at the same time, it's not heavy-handed or preachy. It's just like the characters are fascinating and there's a lot of really sarcastic kind of dark humor. So I try to read fiction and it's hard for me to carve out space for that in my life, but I'm always happy when I do. And that was a great one.
Well, that sounds very interesting. I'm actually curious, are you willing to tell us what you will be naming your daughter?
I am not, because no one knows. My parents don't know. My wife's parents don't know. We have a name and the world will learn the name when they learn it.
Well, that'll be very exciting to learn what the name is, and congratulations. That's really exciting to hear. Well, I guess that wraps it up for today. Thank you for listening to another episode of Upzoned. Keep doing what you can to build a strong town. Thanks, everybody. Let me show you what I'm-